Well, good morning. My name is John Heaton. I'm the head of school at New Covenant Schools in Lynchburg, Virginia, and I've just finished my 10th year there. We serve in K through 12 about 335 students, and Marion Patterson has just finished her 11th year, so we've worked together for a decade and had a lot of fun doing that. She has been our grammar school principal and now has taken on the additional role of middle school principal, but like many schools for 17 years of our existence, we were divided as grammar school K through 6 and then upper school 7 through 12. This seminar is a case study in how and why that's changing, and then if that's fruitful for you, we hope that it's helpful in terms of understanding why middle school and why you might need that. So let's begin. I will share with you just a couple of slides, and then Marion is going to come and carry the real heavy freight on this topic. And please be interactive and stop and ask questions, because you may have some, and there's no need waiting to the end for those. You'll notice, first of all, that the slide that you're currently looking at says middle school for dialectic, which should obviously signal to you that this is some sort of huge compromise. The language that you expect in classical circles is that we have a school of dialectic. You know, why is middle school creeping back into the vocabulary? Maybe you're not wondering that, but we're not really afraid to use this term. We think that they are mutually modifying, insofar as dialectic is not understood well by our parent community, and frankly, while it's understood by most of our faculty, it doesn't have a lot of communicable content. It's actually hard to have a conversation with someone to communicate what dialectic entails. If you're going to say, for example, that in our grammar school we teach grammatically, that's pretty easy to do if you've been around classical education for a while. But when you start talking about dialectics and then look around for historical models as though there was a school of dialectic somewhere in the 12th century, well, that's not true. And it becomes a much more squishy thing. So we've just gone back and used some more terms that are familiar to our people. That's all. But we did want to sort of, you know, twist that classically. So we say middle school for dialectic. And next year we'll be carving out grades 5 through 7 as our middle school, and then ultimately it'll go 5 through 8. And Marion will give you the justification for why we're doing that. What I want to begin with is how we come to terms with dialectic. Most of our schools, of course, are organized around the trivium, and I'm not going to give you an exposition of that except to remind you that Sayers says that these are not subjects at all. What Sayers goes on to say, rather off the cuff and in a rather unintentional way, meaning she's not trying to launch 200 schools in the United States 50 years after she's done with this. She's just having a conversation with people, by the park, and she says some interesting things in the essay, The Lost Tools of Learning. What she does is she psychologizes the trivium and says grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric are, are Paul Parrott, pert and poetic. And those are her words, and they're perfectly good. But if if you've read Wisdom and Eloquence by Little John and Evans, you know that what she's doing there is projecting a kind of intuitive stage theory in which you have grammar followed by dialectic followed by rhetoric. Now, if that's the way you understand Sayers, then you're going to feel this enormous burden to sort of make a school of dialectic, right? Well, what does that look like and what does that mean? Well, I'm not sure that we have to go there. I think we need to understand Sayers for what she was saying and for the contribution that she was making. But we also need to recognize that really grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric are not successive stages as much as they are modes of learning. Your middle schoolers are still doing very grammatical things, as well as your rhetoric students. It's not a nice, tidy little box. You already know that. But I just want to liberate you from the burden if you're trying to carve out, you know, a middle school or trying to firm up your rhetoric school, sometimes you feel the tyranny of saying, well, gee, are we doing this rhetorically? Is there too much grammar here? Forget about that. Don't worry about that. You know, your instincts are probably right. You know, you need some tools, but we don't need to get wrapped up in trying to be too literal with Dorothy Sayers, who didn't intend to do this anyway. She was
a novelist,
exactly. Self-professed non-expert in education. All right. So that said, we're familiar with grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric, and what we're coming to terms with is dialectic, and most classical schools have organized their curriculum around these modes. Now, there is some research that indicates that grades 5 through 7 are the appropriate segmentations for this, and I think that's a moving target. I think the way children may have been in 1920 may be very different than the kind of kids that are sitting in our chairs in 2008. Before Marion comes to kind of move this beyond, let me just anecdotally share this with you. I remember when I was in the fifth grade, I remember that I sort of became self-consciously aware of my abilities. I don't know if you ever had this moment. It happened to me again when I was a junior in college, but that's another story. You have these moments where you kind of hit a developmental tripwire and you realize, wow, I'm kind of peaking here. Here's how it happened. When I was in first grade, the school that I went to, which was back then a Christian day school set up to flee inner city public schools, not a classical school at all, but sort of old school. Kind of felt like a Norman Rockwell school from the 1940s, although it was 1969. But we learned 10 Bible verses per week. Now, we didn't have grammar of history timeline or anything else, but on Wednesday morning, you would get your 10 verses. You would have Wednesday, Thursday to learn them. Friday, you said them individually to your teacher and had to write them out. Monday was a rehearsal day. Tuesday was a rehearsal day. Wednesday was recitation. You got up in front of the student body with your class and recited all 10. You did that for 6 weeks, and on the 6 weeks, you did 60. So you went back and pulled them forward. And we did this for 36 weeks. And we did it in second grade, and we did it in third grade, and we did it in fourth grade. And when I got to fifth grade, I found that I could come back from recitation on Wednesday morning at 9 o'clock, which was the first thing we did. They would give us the next 10 verses. And by the fifth grade, I could learn them by heart in 15 minutes. It was done. Now, I realized that something was happening here, and I didn't think I was special. There were other kids in the class who could do it faster. Okay, but I remember that Mrs. Sanders, my fifth grade teacher, somehow capitalized on this surge. You know, we were sort of peaking in our grammatical abilities. I can't do that now, which is why you do that stuff with little kids, you know. But the reason I bring that up is simply to say that fifth graders, you know, at or about fifth grade, some serious, significant developmental changes begin to occur. And I think that as Marion unpacks this for you, maybe your own experience will resonate with the fact that the kids are changing and we need to change the way we teach. But that may or may not look exactly like you imagine dialectics is supposed to look. So, Marion, why don't you come here and carry the heavy freight? You need a mic up, though.
And you're gonna flip the slides, or you're gonna give me the thing.
You could just hit the arrow button when you want to go forward.
The arrow.
Can you have a pocket?
No, I don't have a pocket.
Okay. You hit the arrow when you want to go forward.
Where's the arrow? And ever since, ever since I've been at New Covenant, we've all been trying to come up to the standard of Mrs. Sanders. John's held that out for us. He told us that story many years ago, and we've all wondered how we could get there. And so recently I attended a conference about middle school and about how to approach children in middle school in ways that would be more effective and more helpful for them. I'm sorry, I still don't see the button. Which button?
That's your recorder, just set this.
This button.
Yeah, there you go. The arrow key.
Thank you.
Hit it again. Again. One more time.
There you go. Okay, so let's note a few things developmentally about students around the fifth grade and beyond, and some of the reasons that we felt like we needed to approach them a little differently. First of all, children in the age bracket from age 10 to 14 are going through the period of greatest developmental change that they will go through throughout their whole lives, other than from birth to about 3. You have huge variability between 10-year-olds and 14-year-olds. Not only that, you have huge variability in a group of 10-year-olds. Some of them are developmentally very young, where some are developmentally maybe as much as 4 years ahead of others. They can vary, even the same child can have huge variability in his own development. For example, physically he might be about 12 years old, emotionally he might be 8, or you might even have the reverse. So there's just huge variability with these kids, which makes them somewhat awkward, somewhat always needing to adapt to the changes that are going on in their own lives. Students in this age bracket certainly are looking for increasing independence, which is one reason that we thought to reorganize them into a middle school plan. Unlike most large school districts, where middle school would be formed out of a number of elementary schools putting their students together, we didn't have that hurdle to overcome. We just regrouped our own students into a middle school, so we don't have the huge transition issues that you might have with a large school district. But we still wanted to begin to manage our 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th graders a little differently than we were managing other students. 5th grade, in particular, we put into that grouping so that we could begin to give them a little more independence. Students in ages 10 to 15 or 10 to 14 are still wide open to influence from their parents, but they have an increasing interest in peers and what their peers think. I think that's apparent to all of us. They're less communicative about their day-to-day activities with their parents, but are not necessarily secretive. They just begin to be a little more inwardly focused. They need less regimen or less structure at school, but still require some predictability in their structure. One mistake I'll share with you that we made this year when we began to do some middle school type activities with the fifth graders is that we gave them lockers in the hallway with the upper school students. We found fairly quickly that that was too much freedom too fast, and so that we got all kinds of little behavior issues going on, and the fifth graders annoyed the older kids and that sort of thing because they didn't manage their own behavior quite as well as they could have. So as we go into this next year, we'll start with a little more structure for the fifth grade and then let it out a little more gradually. Some more characteristics of fifth and sixth graders. Intellectually, they have the highest alpha wave output ever in their lives, and they can learn as much in 12 months as other students can in 24 months. This is what John's illustrating with his Mrs. Sanders story. He was able to easily memorize copious amounts of information, easily take in many new details that an older student could not. They are concrete thinkers at this age. They have the greatest need for praise at this age, and an insatiable need for facts. I'm sure you've all had that student in your classes who knows far more than you do about some obscure subject, or dinosaurs, or stars, or whatever their interest is. That's something we can capitalize on as educators. Socially, fifth and sixth graders still enjoy friends of the same sex. Boys and girls see one another as equals. I'd say this was particularly true sort of at the beginning of fifth grade, less true as you move towards sixth grade and the end of sixth grade. I think these are the first years that we really see the queen bee and the rat pack characteristics emerging, which you will find later in later in 7th and 8th grade even more pronounced. By queen bee, we just mean that there's usually somewhat of a competition among 5th grade girls for who's going to rule the roost. And there's a little bit of a pecking order as far as who's in charge, who decides who plays what role in the games that they play, who decides who sits by whom at lunch, who gets to pick for teams, all that kind of stuff comes out at this age as kids become more aware, as John said, of their own abilities and more aware of their own desires to rule sometimes. The male version of that is the Rat Pack. Boys at that age are also very competitive. However, their competition tends to take less of a verbal form, less of a social form, and more of a physical form sometimes. A lot of times it's not outright fighting, especially at smaller private schools. It might be just this number in the hallway so that the weaker student trips or falls or dominance is just exerted in one way or another. Seventh and eighth graders, intellectually, they move from being such concrete thinkers to a little bit more transitional thinkers. They're more interested in examining things that they have held as true in previous years. This is a great age, for example, to begin dealing with theology as opposed to merely Bible and Bible stories, because they're really interested in thinking about how things fit together, about the why questions that underlie some of the stories they've learned. They're the least able to handle criticism of pretty much any age in your school. I found this out very quickly when I moved from teaching kindergarten and first grade up to teaching seventh grade English, which I hadn't taught for a number of years. And it very quickly became apparent to me that a first grader, you can correct them all day long about their handwriting, their posture, the look on their face, anything. They'll still love you, they'll still hug you, and they'll still worship you. If you do that to a seventh grader, if you correct a seventh grader in front of his peers, you've lost them. You might as well leave the room or have them leave, because you're not going to connect with them and you're not going to be able to teach them effectively for the rest of that class period, and you're going to have some work to do to rebuild that relationship. So I think that was an important lesson for me to learn about that age, or to recall about that age. This is also another one for teachers of seventh and eighth graders. And another key reason that we moved to more of a middle school plan as opposed to a high school plan for 7th and 8th graders. They have a limited attention span. And your typical high school teacher might think that he or she could lecture for 50 minutes and expect to retain the attention of 7th and 8th grade students. And some can do that. However, as I've taught 7th grade myself and 8th grade and watched others do this, seems to be more effective for them if you change it up somewhat during the course of your hour and you integrate subjects so that you're not simply lecturing, giving information, but you're requiring feedback from them as well. Some of the ways we've done this would be to take, say, a 5-minute short break, reorganize students into small groups and have them solve a problem, and then come back to the large group and share the answers to their problem or the question that they just answered, as opposed to me just telling them the answer. So somewhat like you would think with younger children, break it up, use different methodologies, put in different kinds of activities, you'll keep their attention a little bit better. This is also an interesting statistical little tidbit. Even as fifth graders, generally speaking, have the highest alpha output and can manage the most new facts and information. Seventh graders, eighth graders around that age typically have the lowest alpha output. So at our school, what we were doing some years back was going K through 6 with a pretty static kind of management and program. Getting to sixth grade, yes, it was a little more academically challenging than fifth grade, but the big jump was to seventh grade. We put students into algebra and a little more formal Latin instruction, and we counted those grades that they were receiving in algebra and Latin towards their high school transcript. Well, many 7th and 8th graders faltered in those two classes, particularly, partially because they were taught somewhat in a high school way, partially because they were dealing with so many transition issues themselves that they were unable to focus as well as they should have been, and partially just because of this fact, the low alpha output at these transitional stages. So it might be something you want to consider as you do your academic plan, what you want to throw at your 7th and 8th graders. They need challenge. They need to be able to test themselves in increasingly adult-like roles, but they sometimes will struggle with huge amounts of new academic information. Socially, 7th and 8th graders. We see emerging interest in the opposite sex and some boy-girl separation, where in 4th grade they kind of more played together as a group, more interacted together as a group. By 7th and 8th grades, you're definitely seeing the girls hanging with the girls, the guys with the guys more. Solitude seems to be important for 7th and 8th graders at home. They might be in the bedroom with the door shut a little more often than they have been before, a little less interactive with their family. They certainly can be defiant at this age. I know at the conference I attended, there's a good bit of time spent on this, and in secular circles they felt that, you know, this was a characteristic of the age and that it would go away by 9th grade and parents would get their same child back at the end. I think, yes, that can happen. It doesn't always without your continued care and input. Peer pressure becomes more and more powerful in these ages as students are seeking to establish their own identity as part of their family, as part of their school, and as an individual. They're paying lots of attention to what everyone else is saying. And the queen bee and the rat pack phenomenon is just going to get larger. Students are going to organize themselves in this way throughout their day whenever they get the chance. One way I would see this would be in the beginning of 7th grade, the rush when they were changing classes to get the treasured seats. And there's certain seats in the class that were highly valued and others that were not. And it wasn't always even consistent which seat it was until finally they sort of relaxed and they got through that. One girl one day came to class and said, "I am just so embarrassed because everyone is rushing into class to grab these seats." And she said this in front of the whole class, and it did kind of turn a switch for them. They realized that they were not presenting themselves well due to that behavior. So they can listen and they can modify their behavior. This is just a little summary chart, some of the developmental tasks that students have at these age groups. In 10 through 12 year olds are working with self-esteem, where 12 through 14 year olds increasingly are forming their own identity, again, separate from their parents, separate from maybe peers or friends that they've had before. 10 through 12 year olds tend to be a little more disorganized. 12 through 14 year olds tend to be reorganizing their thinking and themselves. This has huge implications, not just for how they think and how they learn, but for how they take care of their stuff. Yes, sir?
I'm sorry to interrupt you.
That's right.
On the previous screen, I assume you're aware that you had more social factors.
Oh, Jim? Did I skip something? I'm sorry.
No, I just wanted to point out that when I talk with teachers who are new to middle school teaching, the bottom part of your display is probably as important, more important than the top part, because they're so socially aware. They are social monsters.
We have certainly experienced that they can be social monsters and that they can be very unkind to each other. And a little later in the presentation, we're going to talk about some proactive ways that we hope to teach into that situation and get a handle on some of that before they get to that point.
I thought it was interesting that you inadvertently perhaps listed more social things than you did intellectual.
Well, certainly that would be, if you surveyed either teachers or students on approaching middle school, the things that concern them the most. Yes.
I found it interesting that you grouped it 5, 6, 7, 8.
Yes.
And my experience is that 5th grade is a tremendous growth, 6th grade is a consolidation.
Mm-hmm.
More importantly, structural issues and what they need and support because of their nature.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering what is pushing you to group the fifth grade with 6 through 8.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, as we know, and all the information is one, so if we did this research back in the 60s, and focus schools and junior highs, so the 5
the middle school thing.
Most probably 6 through 8. So I lived it, and I was on the white horse, and they were like on the plane to close the I have a real concern
mm-hmm.
for the development stages that
you
mm-hmm. Did you want to say something to that?
Do you want to give the standard response, our response to that?
What is our standard response then? Which one would you like to give?
I think that when we consulted with ISN about this question, mm-hmm. Their research is showing that culturally our children are coming of age faster, even though there are developmental things physiologically that may not, but there are cultural things that are actually changing the way students come and deal with these that were not true perhaps in the 50s and 60s. Some of that, I think, is exactly the kinds of technology that Peggy's talking about next door. You've got a different kind of student coming to you, much more self-aware about certain things earlier. And it may or may not be a wise thing. We look back in 20 years from now, I might say this was a huge mistake.
Mm-hmm.
But I think your point is very well taken.
We sort of divided up in that our fifth, sixth graders were okay classes, so intellectually we're treating them as if they were middle schoolers. They have the different teachers that have the educating right. schedule. But then socially we're keeping them mm-hmm. where everybody's still happy. And then our logic school starts in seventh grade. So then mm-hmm. socially they get lockers. They get
mm-hmm.
their space, their private space, and that kind of thing, so
we separate
it out.
Yes?
I'm just wondering how parents react to that. I know that I have a fifth grade son, and I have a seventh grade for a sixth grade daughter, and eighth grade daughter, and I'm not sure why I would feel comfortable with my fifth grade son interacting
yes.
with my eighth grade daughter as a friend.
Well, and I would agree with that to some extent. Our parents reacted very favorably to this move in our case, simply because, again, we weren't combining a number of schools into one. We weren't putting them into a large anonymous group of middle schoolers. What we were doing was moving them to a different part of the building so that they would be able to change classes with just sixth graders. Our fifth graders do not change classes with the eighth graders at this point. When we plan, for example, the middle school retreat, sixth and seventh grade this year will spend the night at the camp that we're going to. Fifth grade will join them the next day, so that fifth grade we're going to begin our year managing much like we managed in grammar school, gradually let out the rope, and then mix them a little more with sixth and seventh graders. Again, it wasn't the huge transition for us that it could be in a larger school system. We still only have six faculty in the middle school who will be teamed and who will be sharing these kids. We felt like that one deciding factor for the parents reacting positively was the fact that we planned for an advisory group, a small group of eight students meeting with a faculty member across fifth through eighth grades. So, and those would be grade specific, so you wouldn't have a fifth grader in with an eighth grader in advisory. So I think our parents got the impression that there was a different structure, but plenty of structure and plenty of supervision, and actually more attention to the students and more opportunities for them at this age. Yes, sir?
Good question. The next slide, it's kind of combined with the ones that you just covered. One question I had was, with the research,
mm-hmm.
is this research, two questions. One, the research tied to, is it really studying American children?
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I found fascinating, my wife is from Germany, and it was just so interesting to see the cultural difference of teenagers. To sit with her brother, who was 13, having a birthday party with his grandparents, his uncles and aunts and mm-hmm. relatives and friends, socializing together, and that's the norm.
Mm-hmm.
We would say, developmentally, kids are going to separate. And mm-hmm. it's culture, not development.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say,
yeah. Is that just a family who happens?
No, this is normal. This is very normal in Europe. very, very normal. That's you learn to drink socially. There are so many things that are very different, and it's cultural, not developed. Sometimes we equate the two. I'm always curious when we look at studies, how do we say this is an American thing that's very unique? And the second part of that question goes back to how are we challenging families? Because your point about sort of the idea of the difference in the kids in the 50s versus today, we are structuring our schools in ways that kind of take that into consideration, but how are we also challenging some of the tendencies and habits of families that exacerbate these
problems? Good question. I think I understand a little more where you're going with this. I would say in our families, in our particular school setting, that it would be the norm for families to celebrate birthdays together with the grandparents. It's still the norm at our house with our grown children to do that, and it was all through. I don't think the school, and by reorganizing where fifth grade meets, and the fact that they meet with fifth and sixth graders and change classes, facilitates breaking away from the parents. I do think that students intellectually grow and change kind of in the Sayers sort of way, such that they're able to think differently about themselves and about others. I do think they become more aware of who they are as individuals within the context of their family. Just as John said, he realized his abilities. I think when I would talk about organization and forming identity and testing in an adult-like role, I wouldn't see that as breaking away from the family or excluding the family, but as becoming aware of who you are as a person, even within your family structure. So if I said separate, as I don't think I meant that they have to, you have to plan the birthday party only with the kids.
It's my reason for raising that is sometimes we take this and it leads to certain belief systems amongst adults that this is my child is going to do this, you know, and that was my only. And sometimes just research can lead us to sort of assumptions in how we structure social environments.
Okay, go backwards with me a little bit to how we presented this to our parents. They saw it as we were pulling older students back towards a more grammar and more teacher-friendly, family-friendly sort of environment, as opposed to the way I think you all are reading it, we're taking our fifth graders and putting them into an anonymous group with older children. They saw it kind of the other way. And that was one of our larger motivations, was to get 7th and 8th graders into a more student-friendly, curriculum-targeted kind of environment that would meet their needs. Does that clarify that at all? Okay. I would agree with that, and that's why our fifth graders trade with just a couple of teachers that they've known and been exposed to. So it's not a huge, big step for them. By the end of the year, I think we are able to do more with them as far as letting out the reins. Their management in the beginning of fifth grade will be much like grammar school management, but they'll have more teachers. The lockers this year, like I said, we made the mistake of putting them down the hall. They're going to be right outside the teacher's door. And the teacher will be still responsible for them during that class change time. It'll be supervised.
We have found that our sixth grade is really the transition. Sixth grade is still very self-centered.
Okay.
But it's our particular population.
Yeah. And I think you're certainly wise to consider the families and the students that you have. And I don't think for us we made a huge change from how we were doing fifth grade to how we're doing it now. I think we just were able to offer a few more opportunities to them by changing the way we were, the fact that we were allowing them to change classes a little more. So, yes.
Compartmentalized about halfway through the year, the last semester, and meaning that the fifth graders then changed classes for different subjects, and they really shine with that added responsibility. It really rose to the occasion of suddenly being treated, you know, like the sixth graders. Although, mm-hmm. as adults, and we think, well, what's the difference it made to you? But it made a big difference to them, and they really latched on to that and settled in that way.
We'll see what happens this year for our kids too. I hope they will. Yes.
Transition is a real big thing in our school. We start getting credit in seventh grade for language. And our parents see seventh grade as a breakout point, as you've already alluded to. And the only thing that I really am concerned about is this developmental range is that as you, some of those kids that you just alluded to in fifth grade that did very well, you may want to be very concerned about those who are not at the upper end of that development scale in seventh and even sixth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if we are giving them enough time for all to get to the same point for that seventh grade experience by what you could find.
Again, I think our goal in doing this was to give ourselves the space to allow for that time to develop. Like I said, we were kind of pulling seventh and eighth grade back from an expectation that we had of them to function like high schoolers. So I think our idea was to pedal backwards. There is a big dichotomy between fifth and eighth, and I don't mean to imply that those two would be the same at all. And certainly we told our parents that we weren't putting fifth graders in class with eighth graders, so that was not it. The other dichotomy that our school had difficulty with was a faculty member teaching seniors and then teaching seventh graders. And so we're trying to work away from that a little bit too. So.
But would you keep it in mind that you continue to talk, because some schools still are in that mode where a teacher hired usually is one who has taught upper level grades and maybe has one class in the school or two. That can be a big issue.
Sure, and if you see a specific place that you have a question or comment about that, please feel free to speak up. So, I think you've all looked at this slide long enough. Let's move on. Okay, this is John's graph that he made without hard data to back it up. It's a graph of the alpha wave output. That's John's graph. He's just trying to let you know that fifth, sixth grade, they're going to reach somewhat of a peak, as you all know, of ability to learn and master new facts. You're going to see that dip around seventh and eighth grade. So our goal was, again, not to ramp up the academics so high in seventh and eighth grade. Okay, our vision for middle school, to facilitate transitions from grammar to rhetoric or from elementary to high school. There's certainly transition at the beginning and at the end of the middle school. And I think our faculty is aware that there's transition throughout. And to provide age-appropriate support and programs. Class organization, by giving fifth and sixth graders the ability to change some classes, we were able to offer them some opportunities they had not had before. We felt that we were better able in this model to target the pacing to the ability of the students and to target certain learning experiences for them that would be more able to implement in a class changing situation. Our vision for middle school, when we began to think about this, we wanted to come up with our own core values for middle school that would go across our grade levels, across the disciplines, and inform the decisions that we made. The first one is proprietas, propriety or character. So we're seeking to teach, to do a better job of teaching character in these grades. prudentia or sensibility. John, why don't you comment just a little bit on what you mean by sensibility? Would you mind doing that? Yeah. Just take a second. Either way.
Maybe this is a felt need of New Covenant, but we feel like, I actually got this idea from Ken Myers, who gave a lecture on this, maybe in Ken, but talking about how in our culture, what we've really lost at the center is this deep sense of just sensibility. It's not just knowing what is right, but it's this sense of knowing it holistically, where students have few boundaries. We scratch our heads and wonder why in the world would the parent let the kid dress that way? And it's not an issue of they don't know the standard, it's simply no sensibility of appropriateness. So we're trying to do intentional things that that address that specific. Well, I think we've got some bulleted out.
We do, and if we get to the next section of our presentation, we'll see some of those. The third one was civitas, civic duty, which we'll do by projects, volunteer projects, raising awareness of what needs to be done for the group inside the school as well as outside of the school. Program elements. Okay, the first one we have listed here, and I think, John, if I'm right, I have 5 minutes left. Okay. Advisory. Advisory is a small group organization of about 8 students who meet with one faculty member as an advisor about 3 times per week. In this small group setting, we plan for the advisor to develop deep and mentoring types of relationships with the students in his or her group, to work on issues such as study skills, responsibility issues. This is also a place for sensibility instruction. One way we intentionally have planned this in is through a program of teaching protocol or manners. We have a little curriculum that we bought for this, and it teaches children what is the expected or the proper behavior in any given situation. I think it's particularly appropriate to do this in middle school because middle schoolers feel uncomfortable sometimes with themselves. They feel like they don't know how to fit in. They don't know how to approach a group. They don't know how to make friends. Even if they obviously do, they often feel that they don't. So this is a great age to be doing this. It certainly teaches them to be concerned for others as well as themselves. Another problem that we had with 7th and 8th grade is that sometimes parents felt a big jolt between the communication from the 6th grade teacher as one homeroom teacher who knew pretty much everything about their student, to when their student went to 7th or 8th grade, they were getting much less feedback from the teachers. They were having to deal with 6 different teachers instead of one. In this scenario, the advisor becomes the expert and the advocate for that student. So that was a key component, I think, for us. Yes.
Is that during the school day?
20 minutes 3 times per week during the school day. Mm-hmm. Yes. You know, that would be an individual school decision. I think we're going to do single sex, but I think we're going to do single grades. But again, there was debate on that. There is debate on that. Depends on what your goals are to meet there. Certainly the biggest program element of any school is curriculum. We found that we weren't hugely changing the curriculum, say for Latin in 7th grade. We were going to change the method and the approach and the grading and the stress level for the curriculum. We did buy some different types of materials to adjust our curriculum a little bit. Another thing we did with curriculum was to choose some classes to do single gender instruction or single sex instruction. For example, in math in 5th grade, 5th graders, the boys will go to one section of math and the girls will go to another section. We did some reading on this. There's not a huge amount of research out there that I could find on this in 5th grade, but teachers just anecdotally say, gee, if I had only the boys, I could do, or if I had only the girls, I could do this. I could tailor my instruction or target my instruction to the way that they're thinking about this and the way that they're learning. So we're going to try this. It's somewhat of an experiment for us. The parents were all for it. Parents felt like that it eliminated some distraction at these grade levels and that it might help students feel more confident. So we're going to try it. Co-curriculars, this was a big area for us where we felt like we could do some changing. We'll go back to that. Some of the co-curriculars that we're going to be able to offer this year will take place in an exploratory period. We're calling it an exploratory period. We'll add a class play to every class section in the middle school. Every section will do a one-act play at some point during the year. We're going to do some group dance instruction with the 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th graders. At our school in the past, we had begun that in 7th grade and had upper school dances for 7th through 12th grade. We felt like that it might be better to try doing some country dance or country by English country, you know, like the Virginia Reel or the Roger DeCoverley, those sorts of things. We're going to try to tailor those social events more to the developmental stages of 5th through 7th or 8th graders, as opposed to having our 7th graders going to the dance with the 12th graders. Some of the other things in co-curriculars we're going to be doing, we have some property behind our school that's undeveloped, and it's basically undevelopable. A lot of the land in Lynchburg is vertical, and a lot of that is fairly vertical. So the students will be going out with one of our instructors and cataloging the trees and developing the trail and doing some of those sorts of things. We also will be adding intramural sports during this time so that every student will play some team sports within the context of the school day. We'll have time for keyboarding and various other computer type skills such as Photoshop that we'll add in for short times during the day so that we're not giving huge amounts of our curricular time to those, but we're allowing a little inclusion for those. And finally, I think this is our time's up, so this will be my last point. Our biggest goal, I think, here in doing this is to have a positive culture for these students to function in during the school day. And I can see that most of you would be very concerned about that as well. We don't want to establish a culture that's driven by the wider world. You want to establish a culture that's driven by your families, by the church, and by your school. So I guess that's it for that. One of the key points of our school culture is our chapels. So we want to maintain those and use them for genuine worship. We want to also have spiritual retreats, which will give us time to focus on developing students spiritually and raising in their minds the need to take responsibility for their own spiritual development. We want to tailor events that we've already always done, such as our volunteer project we call the Genesis Project. We send our students into the community to do cleanup projects or work projects. We want to tailor those to the abilities of middle schoolers and get the most out of those activities. And let's see, let me turn one more page and I can find that slide. Trips as well, I think, are important for establishing the kind of relationships that you want. We live in an area where there are so many historical venues available that we'll travel with the middle schoolers to Williamsburg and Jamestown, as well as probably to Washington, D.C. And one trip we're really the most excited about, I think I'm the most excited about having been last year, is a mission trip to a little place in Mexico, a little border town in Mexico, where we were able to kind of withdraw as a group, focus on spiritual growth, and also do physical hands-on projects of fence building or house mending or cleaning or those sorts of things. I think this will have a tremendous effect on our students if we can open their eyes a little bit to the world beyond them, because certainly students' development, whether it's developmental or cultural, at this age they tend to be a little focused on themselves. So if they see the needs of others, it might be a little more helpful. Yes. I'm going to take 8th grade to Mexico. 8th grade to Mexico. 5th, 6th, and 7th do have trips within our city and our local area, our state as well. You are free to go because it is I'm a little over time. If you have other questions, I'd be more than happy to stay and answer those for you.